of one of the people or a couple of the people on our list this morning. You may want to stick your finger there because we're going to come to it. But remember, we started last week our kind of our Christmas series, so to speak, although I wouldn't necessarily classify under those terms. But we began our series last week of studying in His name or what it means to be a part of the family of God. And we did so by looking at the lineage of Christ as it is given to us in the Gospel of Matthew in chapter number 1, where Matthew tells us of the lineage of Christ through the bloodline of Joseph. Even though that Joseph was not his biological father or the biological father of Jesus, he gives us the lineage of Joseph because being an adoptive father was just as important in their day and just as relevant as being a biological father. And so he goes by way of Joseph to tell us who was in the family of Christ leading up to his birth. And remember that we looked at some pretty interesting characters. We had a prevailing message that already began last week, and that prevailing message was that the family of God is not made of perfect people. And all of you should have said right on. The family of God is not made of perfect people. Remember that we began with Abraham, this pinnacle person, right, in the story of the Jews. And remember that Abraham was a man of great faith, but also a man of great moral failure. Then after him came his son by the name of Isaac, and we concluded that Isaac was his father's son, that he was a man also of great faith, but he also suffered from the same moral failures of his father. Then Isaac fathered a man by the name of Jacob, who was a liar and a cheater, and Jacob fathered a man by the name of Judah, who was the cold and heartless ringleader of his brother's sorrows. As they cast him into the pit, it was he who decided that he would be worth something if they would sell him into slavery. Now, it would seem to me that there could be no worse cast of characters to begin a discussion on the family of the Lord with than those four men, and yet the problems continue. In fact, this morning what I'm going to suggest to you is that last week was child's play compared to what we're about to encounter in the next list of people. In fact, it goes from really bad to really ugly in a hurry. Matthew chapter 1, beginning in verse number 3, reading down to verse number 6, and it says, "And Judah was the father of Perez and Zerah by Tamar, and Perez the father of Hezron, and Hezron the father of Ram, and Ram the father of Amminadab." And it says, "And Amminadab the father of Nashon, and Nashon was the father of Salmon, and Salmon the father of Boaz by Rahab, and Boaz the father of Obed by Ruth, and Obed the father of Jesse, and Jesse the father of David the king." The next name that comes to us on our list is we are told that Judah was the father of Perez. Once again, remember last week I told you that anytime there is a shift in the writer's writing of his genealogy, it marks an important moment that draws our attention to it and says, stop and look very, very carefully because there is a shift in thinking. There's something I want you to notice. And remember that last week, that shift first occurred in the birth of Judah, where we are told that Jacob fathered Judah and his brothers. Whereas previously, it had only said that this person fathered such and such. In Judah's case, it said, and was fathered Judah and his brothers. Well, when we come to Perez, there's another shift. In fact, there's two shifts in here. And the first is similar to the one we just saw, and that is that this time, Matthew, as the genealogical writer here, tells us not only that Perez was birthed to his father, Judah, but he also lists another brother by name as though that other brother plays an important role in the story itself. In other words, in previous genealogies, he said, such and such fathered such and such, and such fathered such and such. And then when he came to Judah, he says that Jacob fathered Judah and his brothers, but he didn't name any of them. But now that he comes to Perez, he says, Judah fathered Perez and Zerah by Tamar, which is the second shift. You'll notice that he also includes the mother of these children, which has not happened yet as well. Now, this is peculiar because the very reason that Matthew is writing is that he is writing to a Jewish people. And it was very rare in their day to ever include a woman in a genealogy. And yet at this moment, Matthew breaks his tradition and he identifies a very interesting woman by the name of Tamar and says that Jesus came from this lineage of Judah by the birth of Perez and Zerah, who was birthed to them by their mother Tamar, bringing a woman into the discussion very unorthodox. Now, what that means for you and I in 21st century, you say, why should I care about that? Is because what Matthew is saying is, these individuals, I want you to remember their stories. I want you to remember what it was that they did so that you might understand why it is that I am including them. Well, their stories unfold for us in Genesis chapter number 38. I'll let you take a few moments to turn there and you can follow with me. I'm not going to read it verse by verse, but I'm going to go very quickly. The story unfolds as one of the most bizarre and unfortunate stories in all of Scripture. You may remember some of it. The sequence of events is kind of as follows. First of all, Judah decides he needs to find a wife for his eldest son by the name of and he finds a woman by the name of Tamar to marry him. However, the Old Testament in Genesis 38, we are told that did not fear the Lord, and he did what was evil in the sight of the Lord, and so the Lord brought him to an untimely death. In other words, it's a poetic way of saying that didn't follow the Lord, and so the Lord struck him dead where he was at a very young age, leaving behind this newly widowed or this newly married woman, now widowed by the name of Tamar. Now, in their day, God had made provision for such events. And in our day, we think this provision is a little bit crude. But in their day, what God had done was he had given a law. He had given a precedent. He had told the people what to do in such scenarios. And what they were to do in such a scenario, as a woman who was young, without children, who was widowed, she was to be married by another redeemer, specifically by a brother of her husband who had passed away. And the reason that that seems crude to us is because we live in this society and we think, how in the world could anyone marry their brother's sister or brother's wife? But the reality was that God wasn't trying to be crude. He was trying to provide for a helpless individual, which a woman was in their society. He didn't want them to be left destitute, and he wanted for the family name to be able to be carried on. And so it was the responsibility of another brother or a close family member known as a redeemer to come along and to marry the widowed bride and bring about children or heirs of the family name and provide for her as though she was their own. Well, this even is a question that the Sadducees ask of Jesus. If you remember right, they came to him and they proposed a scenario where a man got married and he passed away and six of his brothers followed along and married him. And they asked of Jesus, in the resurrection, whose wife will she be? They wanted to know, in such a scenario, how will this take place? Well, basically what happens in Genesis 38 is that Judah says, you know, we know what's to take place and we know how this is all to unfold. And so he goes to his other son by the name of Onan. And he says to Onan, Onan, you need to marry your brother's widow. And so Onan does so. However, what Onan refuses to do is what the Lord has commanded, and that is that he refuses to give an heir for Judah. He refuses to give an heir for And so he refuses to come into this new wife, into his brother's widow, and to consummate the marriage that has been given to them. So what does God do? God finds this as a slap in the face, as a disrespect, a sign of disobedience, and so he strikes him dead as well, feeling responsible for his daughter-in-law who is now widowed twice. Judah turns to her and he promises that he will give to her his other son by the name of Shelah. However, Shelah is too young to be married, and who wants to marry a boy named Shelah anyway, right? So he says to Tamar, I'm going to give you my other son by the name of Shelah, but you're going to have to wait a little while because he's not of the mature age. However, Genesis 38 unfolds and apparently time goes on. And Judah forgot his promise. And Sheila was not old, comes to an age where he's old enough to get married, but apparently Judah decides that he's going to renege on his promise to Tamar, and he doesn't give him to her. Eventually, Judah's wife, his wife, passes away. And he finds himself in a lonely state. He's all by himself, now widowed, and maybe it was God's way of showing him what he had put Tamar through. And he decides to go on a trip. And when he goes on this trip, his widowed daughter-in-law, Tamar, finds out where he is going, and she decides that she is going to deceive her father-in-law. She goes ahead of him, and she meets him at a location, and she takes off her widow's garments, and she presents herself as a woman of the night, to which Judah goes into her. And all of us understand this is real trouble on the making, right? He asks her what he can offer to her as payment for this arrangement that has been made, and they come to an agreement that a young goat would be sufficient, but he doesn't have a young goat in his billfold. So he says to her, I've got to do something else for right now so that you know, or you can be assured, that I will give you this young goat, that I will make payment for our services together. And so they decide that he will leave with her his signet ring and his staff. And then Judah goes into Tamar, and she conceives twins, and you guessed it, their names were Perez and Zerah. One day, some of the servants, about 3 months later, come to Judah, and they say, Judah, we got a problem here. Your daughter-in-law, the widowed bride, she has been terribly immoral. In other words, Judah, we got a problem here. Your daughter-in-law, who was being preserved for Sheila, the one who you should have already given to her, but you haven't yet, the one who's been sitting over here all by herself, unmarried, widowed twice, she's pregnant, and we have no explanation for how that is. What shall we do about it? Judah says, I know what to do. We're going to take her out, and we're going to burn her. What a statement, huh? So he says, we're going to take her out, we're going to burn her. She's on her way to the stake, and she says, only want you to do one thing for me, boys. She hands the signet ring and the staff to the men who are taking her, and she says, take these to Judah so that he might remember or know, come to know who it was that I had been with. And everybody says, uh-oh, SpaghettiOs. Judah gets hands on his own signet ring and his own staff, and he says, boy, I've made a terrible mistake. All of a sudden, in this moment, like David's sin coming before him, Judah's sin is right in front of him, and he says, she is even more righteous than I. Now, that is a model family for you, right? I mean, this would be a tailor-made season of Days of Our Lives. A woman gets married, young bride, her husband dies. She's married to his brother, he dies. She goes into her father-in-law, and they conceive twins together. Well, in the womb, apparently, Perez and Zerah were a little bit like Jacob and Esau. They didn't really get along all that well. And it comes the time of labor, and Zerah sticks out his arm, and the midwife reaches down and ties a string on his arm so that they can label him as the firstborn, as the heir of the inheritance. However, Zerah pulls his arm back in, and Perez comes bursting out. And the midwife says, well, we're going to call you Perez because of the strange way in which you burst into the world. Perez's story is further complicated when we look a little bit closer into who Tamar was. Not only did she do the unthinkable in deceiving her father-in-law, but she was also a Canaanite woman. She was a woman who wasn't purely Jewish, and it doesn't add to any of her credibility or to her story, but she was one of the people that God was trying to drive out of the land as the people were inheriting the possession of his promise. But I want you to know something. I wish I could spend a lot of time on this morning, but I can't. One thing I want you to know, we could stop here and say, here's another example of a great sinful person, another sinful circumstance in the family of God, but I want you to know Perez's story has an interesting end as well. Perez's story is actually one of redemption. Not a lot of it is recorded of him in Scripture, with the exception of his descendants. However, what is said of his descendants is something of an honor to him. He shows up in two very unexpected places in the Old Testament. First time he shows up is in Ruth chapter 4. Ruth has gone to Boaz and the arrangement has been made. And Boaz is going to redeem her, and he has made the arrangement with the only other person who could have done so. The marriage is arranged, and the people turn to Ruth and they basically say, "May God bless you. May God bless her in the same way that God has blessed the house of Perez." Now, we don't really know exactly how God had blessed the house of Perez, but the statement in itself tells us something. And what is that? That the house of Perez was blessed. In other words, in this moment, when these people looked at Ruth and Boaz, their minds were drawn to something they knew, which I don't, but drawn to something about how God had moved in the house of Perez. And I wish I knew the story, but they basically said, "We hope that you are as fortunate as they were." Then he shows up again in Nehemiah chapter number 11 and verse number 6, where there we are told that Perez left behind him 468 valiant sons to defend Jerusalem. If it's true that a father or a son reflects his father, then these sons, these descendants of Perez, are somewhat depicting who Perez must have been as a person. And that teaches us an important lesson this morning, and that is that our beginning does not define our life. Some people come into the world with a lot of fanfare and excitement. I mean, I think of Prince Charles and Kate, I don't know, I can't even keep it straight, and everybody's on baby watch for like 6 months, right? And they're waiting to see, and they have that kind of fanfare. And then there are other children, other precious gifts of life that come into the world, and we're all kind of like, I don't know if we want to talk about that. But Perez's story is a story of redemption. It didn't matter how he came into the world. It didn't matter that he came in through some of the most vile means possible. What mattered was he was God's precious gift of life. And God apparently used Perez. We're told that Perez fathered a man by the name of Hezron, whom we are told virtually nothing about, excluding the children that he fathered. We're told that Hezron fathered Ram, whom we are told even less about. We're told that Ram fathered Amminadab, whom we know absolutely nothing about. And you say, if we know nothing about such men, does that mean you're done for the day? Almost, not quite. Amminadab, we are told, fathered a man by the name of Nashon. Thankfully, all of God's people said, "We're excited. We do know something about Nashon." What do we know about Nashon? 1 Chronicles chapter number 2, verse number 10, we are told that Nashon was the prince of the sons of Judah. What does that refer to? Well, it refers back to Numbers chapter number 2, where the people were encamped, having come into the wilderness. And there in their encampment, all of the tribes were laid out in specific order because God is a God of order. And he'd put all the tribes around and he'd given them each their place in the encampment. And in that moment, he gave to the people of Judah, to the tribe of Judah, a place on the east side of the encampment. John MacArthur notes about this. He says that it highlighted in that moment the role and centrality that Judah would have in the defeat of Israel's enemies, and Judah was the tribe through which the Messiah would be born. Even all the way back here in the wilderness, God was setting the stage for something special to be coming out of the tribe of Judah. And guess who the leader of that tribe of Judah was in Numbers chapter 2? It's a man by the name of Nashon. Nashon becomes the leader of God's blessed tribe, of God's special tribe, of God's tribe by which he will bring about the Messiah itself. Undoubtedly, Nashon must have been a man, and being a man made mistakes in his life, but Scripture actually only ever speaks of Nashon briefly in a positive light. And so all of God's people said, "Finally, somebody I can relate to. A man of good moral character and standing, an honorable and noble man. I'm tired of all these reprobates," right? That was Nashon, a noble man, an honorable man, a leader of God's special people. Nashon, we are told, fathered Salmon, who we know nothing about. And Salmon fathered a man by the name of Boaz. We're told once again by a new shift that Salmon fathered Boaz by Rahab, whom we know a few things about, don't we? Remember, Rahab was a Gentile prostitute who played a pivotal role in the people's taking of the promised land as God had given it to them. Her story is told to us in Joshua chapter 2, and it's a story of remarkable faith. She takes in two Hebrew spies at the detriment of her own life. She has no reason to bring these men in. She has no reason to protect them. In fact, really, she should have wanted to rat them out because they were coming to take over her land, her people's land. And yet in Joshua 2, what we find is that the men come into town, she welcomes them into her home, and all of a sudden the king somehow finds out that these two men have visited Rahab, and he sends men, messengers, so certainly armed guards, to get these men out and to kill them. And when they come to the door, Rahab says, "I know who you're talking about, but they have already left the city." She lies on their behalf. Boy, if the king's men would have searched her home on that day and found these, they would have certainly have prosecuted her. It probably, most certainly, would have cost her her life. And yet, she stood in that moment for these two men, having known nothing about them except what she records. Listen to these words. She says in that moment, "I know that the Lord has given you the land, and that the fear of you has fallen upon us, and that all the inhabitants of the land melt away before you. For we have heard how the Lord dried up the water of the Red Sea before you when you came out of Egypt, and what you did to the two kings of the Amorites who were beyond the Jordan, to Shiloh and Og," she says, "whom you devoted to destruction. And as soon as we heard it, our hearts melted, and there was no spirit left in any man because of you. For the Lord your God, he is God," she said. She recognized that these men were men of God. And she says, "Your God is the big God, the God of heaven and earth, the God who is doing miraculous things." Then she turns to these men and she says, "Now then, please swear to me by the Lord that as I have dealt with you kindly, you also will deal kindly with my father's house. And give me a sure sign that you will save the life of my father and mother, my brothers and sisters, and all who belong to them, and deliver our lives from death." Must have taken a remarkable amount of faith to ask of these men to do this and to protect them at the detriment of her own life, and yet she did it. We know the rest of the story. Rahab lets the men out of the window of her home to safety. When the city falls, only she and her immediate family are saved. She marries Salmon, and we are told that they had a child, and the child's name was Boaz. Boaz's story is told to us in the book of Ruth, and you guessed it, he marries a woman by the name of Ruth. And you remember their story well, right? In fact, if I say Ruth today, everybody knows the story. If I say Boaz, nobody has any idea what I'm talking about, right? Because Boaz had the same problem that John F. Kennedy had, and he shared on one occasion. Right before his assassination, while he was in Dallas, at Fort Worth, he was sharing at an event of local business leaders, and he says, "Whenever my wife Jackie and I go to Paris, everyone says, 'Are you Jackie's husband?'" He said he knew something about how it meant to live in the world. Think about this. This noble man, a leader of the free world, walks into a restaurant and people want to know, "Are you Jackie's husband?" That's how Boaz lived. He lived in the shadow of Ruth, so to speak, in our world at least. We know his story only through her story, and you remember her story. She was a Moabite woman, a woman of the people of God's garbage dump, and she found herself through a series of unfortunate events all the way back into Bethlehem, searching for a redeemer to marry her. Eventually, she finds a man by the name of Boaz, and Boaz must have grown up listening to the story of his mother. Remember his mother? Rahab. Don't you think God is sovereign? How God puts things together, how there's no coincidences, how God brings things together in the lives of people. All through his life, Boaz must have heard the story of how his mother Rahab was a prostitute, a Gentile prostitute, set on the destruction by God's people, and yet God's people had saved her, right? It was a story of how God was already bringing Gentiles into his family, right? And Boaz grows up hearing this story, and all of a sudden, there is a Moabite woman in town who needs someone to marry her, but nobody's going to do it because she's a Moabite, and Boaz says, guess what? I'll do it. I've heard this story before. In fact, the very reason I'm here is because a Gentile woman was welcomed in by my father. Guess what? I will redeem her. And he goes and he marries this Moabite woman. This Moabite woman, through this story of romance, right? Together they have a son by the name of Obed. Obed fathers a man by the name of Jesse, and Jesse fathers a man by the name of David that all of us know. In fact, Matthew, as he tells the story, says that Jesse fathered David, the king. I like how he says it too, the king. You know, the one everybody knows about. I could spend the rest of our morning and the rest of our coming weeks talking about the life of David, right? The life of Jesse and Obed, but specifically the life of David. I could tell you about how David was a man of great faith who slayed a Goliath giant. I can tell you about how David was a man who spared the life of Saul because he refused to touch God's anointed one. I can tell you about how David was a man who united a kingdom. I can tell you about how David was a man who committed adultery and murder. I can tell you about how David was a man after the heart of God. But for our purposes this morning, I just want to stop and I want to draw a conclusion. Look with me again. What have we seen to this point? In Abraham, we saw a man of great faith and great moral failure. In Isaac, we saw his father's son. In Jacob, we saw a liar and a cheater. In Judah, we saw a ringleader to family aggression. In Perez, we saw a sordid series of family affairs. In the next, we saw an adulterous Canaanite woman. Then we saw a series of no names, and we saw a noble man. Then we saw a prostitute Gentile woman. And then we saw a love story fixed in heaven between a Jew and a Moabitess. And then we saw the greatest king in Israel's history. You might say this morning that in the lineage of Christ, just to this point, we have seen everyone from the brothel to the streets to the aristocracy to the White House itself. It seems that Matthew is painting a portrait of what Jesus was and who he is, isn't it? And I think about this illustration with me this morning. Think with me. How an artist pulls out a canvas, a blank canvas, and he has in his mind a picture that he wants to draw, a masterpiece that you can relate to and understand with, right? And then he pulls out that paintbrush and he begins to paint the very first strokes. And what you and I don't realize is that those very first strokes are the most important of the entire masterpiece. We don't realize it because they get covered up. They get surrounded by all the other things that are around them. That's our problem with Jesus this morning. When we think of Jesus, we think of the water being turned to wine. We think of how he walked on the seas, how he calmed the storm, how he raised the dead to life, how he gave sight to the blind and he gave hearing to the deaf. We think about how he made the lame to walk again, and the list goes on and on and on. But Matthew, in this moment, he pulls out his canvas and he begins to paint a picture of who Christ is. And the very first strokes of the brush, they're the most important to the entire story. And that is that it is the Christian position that there is no one that Jesus did not care about. And the reason that there's no one Jesus didn't care about was because there were so many in his own family. There were so many miscreants and many troublemakers and so many sinners and so many evil and vile people in his own lineage that he came to redeem all. Could it be that Matthew shows us this morning that being there already in the lineage of Christ, all kinds of people from every different walk of life, from every different socioeconomic position, from every different religious experience, that there is no one that God was not concerned with. He's shown us people from the brothel to the streets to the aristocracy to the White House. And it is amazing to me that such men and women could find their place in the family of God. And I guess it gives me hope this morning. Because if such men and women could find their way in the lineage of the Messiah, then it says something about that Messiah who came. And what does it say? Matthew was writing to the Jews, but he breaks the rules in his lineage of Christ to tell you that Jesus Christ did not come into the world to save merely the Jews, but he was the Messiah for the entire world. There is not one group of people that has ever existed that he did not come to save. I think of the fulfillment of this promise in Revelation, where we are told that on that great day will be people from every tribe and nation and tongue, from all around the world. I look forward to that day. I'm excited about that day. I look forward to being able to worship with people that don't look like me, talk like me, sound like me, act like me. And you should have said, right on. I want to worship with those kind of folks. I look forward to that day when every group of people won't be divided by whether they're white or black or African American or Hispanic or Indian or anything else. They won't be divided by how much money is in their wallet or in their bank account or by anything else. They will just be one people, the family of God. And Matthew says, you better know this, that the Christ who came from such a lineage. He came from a group of people that made up every group of people. He came as a Messiah for all. No doubt, Matthew set out in Matthew 1 to prove the fulfillment of the prophecy that Jesus was of the line of David. It was a necessary prophecy to be fulfilled, but it seems that in this moment he decided to go a little bit further. In fact, if you'll go down with me to verse number 17, it says, so all the generations from Abraham to David were 14 generations, and from David to the deportation to Babylon was 14 generations, and from the deportation to Babylon to the Christ, 14 generations. Now, you don't have to be a math wizard to figure out that that's 42. And if you'll go back and look at the list and you'll look in your study Bibles, what you're going to find is that Matthew doesn't actually tell us all of the names. He doesn't tell us every generation. That means that along the way, as Matthew is telling the lineage of Christ, there's some names he's leaving out. And I think to myself this morning, if you were going to leave out some names, you might have started with some of these guys, buddy. I mean, why tell the story of Perez? Why tell the story of Tamar? Why tell the story of Rahab? Why not keep it nice and clean? But you see, Matthew wanted to lead us to an undeniable truth this morning, and that is that if these people made it into the family of God, so can you. I hope this morning that you would find your name in the lineage of Christ. And you can put it there by simply placing your faith and trust solely in him. You're not called to be perfect or righteous or noble or rich. Jesus Christ came into the world to save you, to welcome you into a family so great that it cannot be divided by the normal social standings. He came to welcome you into his family. Greatest family for all of eternity, knowing who you were, what you were, and all that you would be, and redeeming you from those things through his precious work on the cross of Calvary on your behalf. There is no one today that cannot make their way into the family of God by the precious work of his son, Jesus. Would you stand with me reverently and let's pray?